Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, July 25th, 2010, and this is show number 270. Man, we're creeping up on 300 here. Well, we have a really good show this week, so I'm not going to dilly-dally getting into it. Let's go ahead and get started. On our trip to Disneyland, of course I brought lots of gadgets with me for entertainment throughout the day and back at the hotel. The thing about Disneyland is there's lots of standing in line, so having a distraction device on you is a huge advantage. I debated at first on whether to carry the iPad around, but since I got that great backpack purse from REI, the weight and size are zero issue, so I threw it in my bag. Call me a geek. I can take it. Well, Lindsay's boyfriend Nolan was with us, and his family are really into playing games, so he's a big influence on how much I spent on apps for the iPhone and iPad while we were in line. The first one he turned me on to is called Flood It from LabPixies.com. This simple little game is available for iPhone and Android, but it's also on the web on Orkut, Hi5, Facebook, MySpace, and even iGoogle. The purpose of the game is to turn the playing board into all one color. It starts with a mixture of squares of different colors. Outside of the grid are the six colors kind of in a row. You click on those buttons to connect colors together. It's really hard to explain, but if you play it once, you'll immediately have the hang of the game. You only have so many moves to accomplish your task, which is the challenge. You can change the density of the board from a grid of 14 by 14 square all the way up to 28 by 28. Now, I told Chief Nocella Castaway Rose about this game, and she hasn't gotten a lick of work done since. Yeah, she thanked me for that. The iPhone app is free, so you should definitely download it if you'd like to reduce your productivity. Now, LabPixies doesn't appear to have an iPad version, but have no fear. You can waste time with abandon by buying SuperFlood HD for iPad from Virtusoft.com for one measly dollar. That's a small price to pay for that much productivity loss. SuperFlood HD also lets you use not only a square grid, but a hexagon grid, which is actually way easier because you get six sides touching each other. You can clear out more colors. Well, Nolan also put Sporkle on my phone. If you want to feel really dumb, check out Sporkle.com. That's S-P-O-R-C-L-E. Sporkle bills itself as mentally stimulating diversions. The idea is you pick a topic area, like U.S. states, commonest English words, The Simpsons, or the periodic table of the elements. You're supposed to come up with the answers to the clues they give you within a ridiculously small number of minutes. I couldn't even get the answers to the Seinfeld sayings, even though we've been watching Seinfeld every night for years in syndication, and we even watched it back when it was in primetime. They think I can do the states? The periodic table? Yeah, right. Well, Lindsay and Nolan play this game all the time, so they're really good at it, but I pretty much feel like an idiot when I'm playing. I'm so glad there was a portable version on my iPhone. Thanks, Nolan. I put a link to Sporkle Lite on iTunes in the show notes, and if you don't feel like an idiot playing it, then you might want to invest the $2 for the full game. I'm going to go back to mindlessly poking at colored squares or maybe playing some more Boomshine where you just poke the screen and watch bubbles burst. That's more my intellectual speed, I'm afraid. I do have to tell you, though, the iPad was a huge hit when we were waiting for the fireworks at Disneyland. These two little kids came up and started helping Lindsay and Kyle play Superflood. It was like a magnet to these kids. Lindsay and Kyle were sweet to them, but after about a half hour, they were getting pretty tired of them, so they switched over to play Scrabble. But unfortunately, the kids insisted they were skilled at Scrabble, too. They were like 5 and 7 years old. I was pleased that neither of my kids did a W.C. Fields, "Go away, kid, you bother me." They were really nice to him. Speaking of Chief Nocella Castaway Rose.
G'day, girls and boys. This soundbite is short and sweet, just like me. Pause for laughter. Oh, damn it, I wasn't supposed to say that one out loud. Anywho, when Al did a segment on recently discovering Gary and his Mac Most Now podcast, I was shocked. I've been subscribed to his podcast for ages. I'm guessing that we all assume that we all know all the cool podcasts. But, now one thing we do all know is that the princess demands a problem and a solution. The problem? I don't want to miss out on any cool internet stuff. The solution? All the Nocilla castaways should post a list of all the podcasts they listen to or watch. Unless, of course, their list is hideously embarrassing. Perhaps on the beautifully redesigned Nocilla Cast website. What do you reckon? And to finish, I'm sure I speak for us all when I say I'd love a picture of the princess and my darling's DVP dressed up as Mickey and Minnie. Stevie, remember when I let you take a picture of me in mouse ears? Love you long time.
Well, I can never resist any of Rose's requests. She asked so sweetly. I happen to have a photo taken at Disneyland where I'm actually effectively, though not technically, dressed as Minnie Mouse. I'll put that in the show notes for her, but I'm afraid we don't have one if Steve is Mickey. We do have something that you might like even better, though. We took our picture with Mickey Mouse, and we made him do Live Long and Prosper. See, this was pretty funny because he only has three fingers and a thumb, but he bore up under pressure and made it work. The best part was at the end I asked him, I said, are we the first people to ever ask you to do, oh, I should say, after we had him do it, he did a face palm, a face plant. He took his face and threw it down into his palm. And he said, and I said, is this the first time you've ever had someone ask you to do Live Long and Prosper? And he vigorously nodded his head. So that was kind of fun to be the first geeks to make him do that. All right. As far as the idea of a page where we could all list our favorite podcasts, someone else is going to need to set this up. You know I love you guys, but I'm not going to take Rose's suggestion and give you all write access to my website. If someone wants to start a wiki page or a pirate pad we can all write on, I'm all for it, and I would gladly link to it. But access to my site? Ain't gonna happen. So who's up for the challenge to set up some kind of format? Maybe it could have Rose with all the names of the shows, and then everybody put their name next to them if they listen to that one, kind of thumbs up it, that sort of thing. That would be cool. I'd like to have the Nocilla Castaways view on that. But I'm not going to do any of the work.
Ooh, I should hit the red button, shouldn't I?
This is a good start, Bart.
Okay, now we're good.
Okay, I'm already recording.
Ah, you're not allowed to do that.
Okay, this is getting really confusing. We're on the air, but Chit Chat Across the Pond hasn't started yet. We haven't even had the Honda Bob commercial.
Yes, but those of us in the future that you're about to hear in a while realize that we'd forgotten something, so we're preemptively fixing that omission.
But see? Doing it ahead of time to confuse everyone.
And us. Especially us.
The real question is, am I going to play the music? That'll be really confusing.
Yeah.
Play half the music. Anyway, okay, so we're back in the future. Because we forgot one thing in Security Light that we meant to talk about. Why don't you let us know what's going on, Bart?
We're back from the future.
Oh, right. Huh?
Which is even better. Okay, so we skipped over this one by mistake. A security researcher has released details of a sort of, I guess you'd call it a class of attack. It doesn't attack a particular browser. It attacks a feature that's common to many browsers, which is the form autocomplete features, which you get in Safari, i.e. Firefox or Chrome.
Oh, I like those. That's where I start typing my name or my address or something like that, and it starts filling it in for me, right? Those are good.
Well, no, the fact that it fills it in is good. The fact that you can use a bit of JavaScript to fill it in on a hidden form that you can't see and harvest lots of data from you without you ever noticing and sending it all back to the attacker, that's not so good.
Oh.
So if you'd auto-filled in your credit card... Yeah, I know. If you'd auto-filled in your credit card, it could get called up by these kind of attacks and sent off.
I don't think these things ever do the credit card. Somehow they always know. Oh, no. I have seen it.
I'm lying. It depends. Like, it basically, it just stores the name of the form, the name of the text area. And if it sees that text area again, it says, oh, I remember what you did here last time. And it barfs it back out. So they just need to find a common name that would be used for credit card numbers and, I don't know, some sites around the place.
Yeah.
The other thing with Safari is Safari actually ties into your address book when it tries to figure out stuff. So it can actually get information that you've never entered into your browser and give that away to the bad guys too.
Like what? What could be bad out of my address book? I mean,
well, mainly your address and your phone number and, you know, the kind of stuff about you that would allow the bad guy to impersonate you quite easily.
That sounds kind of weak. That didn't sound like a big risk, does it? I mean, come on. My address? That isn't much. You'd have to have other stuff to really be useful.
Yeah, but if it's your whole entry in the address book, doesn't that get a bit worrying?
I suppose. But what are they going to do with that? They don't know who I am or why they care about me.
Yeah, but if you put together all the information you've ever typed into a website, doesn't that give an awful lot of information? Oh, that
the other stuff, sure, but the address.
Yeah, but it's all. Yeah, but it all adds together. It's not every one piece. You can argue isn't that important.
Okay.
But when you add all those little not important pieces together, the sum of everything is a fairly substantial amount of information.
Wah. So does that mean I have to? It has to go away. I can't use autofill anymore.
Well, it depends on how whether you want to make the judgment that you're prepared to take the risk because
do you
find
lucky?
The convenience. Well, for now, this is a theoretical attack because the guy is about to do a big presentation of it. So,
it's possible. Black Hat Week, isn't it?
Black Hat Week, yeah.
That's what's going on here.
But okay, so for now, we don't have any evidence that this is really happening.
Okay.
But that could change. So you could argue that you're just going to keep an eye on things, and when it does become a real problem, then reevaluate. Or if you're like me and you just forget stuff, I'm just going to do it now and then it's done.
Okay, but that means forever I have to type in everything all the time, right?
Actually,
even if I always
fill
out the form?
I always do that because I always find it really freaky when it fills it out for me.
Oh.
How did you know?
So this is a Windows-only problem, right?
Oh, no. No, it's browser-based. So basically the whole thing runs off JavaScript.
Hmm.
So what you do is you set up a hidden form element somewhere in the document, use JavaScript to give it a few different names and things and see what the browser plugs into those names and then record it all and whoosh it back.
Yeah. So what browsers does it affect?
Well, it definitely, you know, this is not necessarily an exhaustive list, but it definitely affects IE, Firefox, Chrome, and Safari. Which is pretty exhaustive, really, actually, when you think about it.
Okay, yeah, that's pretty much everything I have.
What I thought we might do is just talk people through how you disable this in different browsers. Now, I don't have a copy of IE, so I don't know how you do it in IE. But if we start with Google Chrome, you just go to Preferences, which on the Mac is under Chrome Preferences, and on Windows, I would guess, is going to be under Edit Preferences.
Sure.
That's how these things normally go, isn't it?
Right.
Then the Chrome Preferences pane is wonderfully minimalistic. It's got three tabs: basics, personal stuff, and under the bonnet. So you go to personal stuff, and then there's a checkbox saying disable autofill.
Okay.
And that's that.
Got it.
So that's beautifully easy.
Okay.
Then Safari, to be honest, isn't much more difficult. So again, you go to Safari Preferences, or probably Edit Preferences in Windows. In this case, there's a tab called autofill, which
That's
not
pretty easy.
Yeah. So then you just turn off, basically it gives you a couple of checkboxes, so you can say using info from my address book card, you can turn that off, and that covers that much. You can leave on usernames and passwords and turn off other forms, which could be handy, or vice versa. So you can control it at three levels here.
Okay, so which one is the scary one, just the address book one?
To be honest, it's a call. The other forms one scares me the most, to be honest, although if someone manages to harvest your usernames and passwords, that could be interesting too, so... To be safe, I would say just turn them all off, but no, definitely the address book one would be one I would absolutely turn off.
It looks like you can remove specific websites from the other forms. Like I've got a whole bunch of them for .AAA, .Aerolingus, .Amadeus, .Amazon, .Ambrosia Software. I can click them one at a time and remove them.
Well, I guess that's everything it's learned off so far. So you can make it forget specific things, but I'm sure it'll re-remember them.
Yeah.
That's just what it's learned.
Okay, I may turn it off. Other names and passwords, I don't like that one. That one was off by default, I think.
It is, actually, which is no harm, because that way it pops you up the... Actually, I'm not sure. I don't use Safari enough to know what it does or doesn't do.
Yeah.
But it is off by default, which I don't think is any harm.
Okay.
And then in Firefox, it took us a little longer to figure it out.
I think we actually had to go onto the web to Firefox Help to find it, didn't we?
Well, you found it in Help quicker than I found it poking around blindly, which doesn't say very much for Firefox's interface here, because to be honest, I got it pretty easy on the others.
Yeah, you know, I got to tell you, every single time I try to empty my cache in Firefox, it takes me about 6 minutes to find it.
It's under a history, because that's obviously where it should be.
Well, there isn't a history tab.
No, it's in the menu. So, history, and the...
No, it isn't.
Shoot, where'd it go?
You
tools,
see?
Tools, that's it. Tools.
Tools?
Clear recent history.
Oh, see, I do it always in the under the privacy settings or something, and I go to, I don't know, it takes me forever. I'm not going to spend
our time.
It's
never where I expect it. Every time I go for it, I find it eventually, but it's never where I expect it to be.
I never would have thought looking under tools, that's for sure. Okay, so yes. Back to the autofill form. Where did we find it
so
again?
So we go Firefox, preferences, or edit preferences if you're in Windows. And then there's a tab called privacy, which has a cute little mask icon.
That is lovely. Okay.
Then under history, you have Firefox will colon, and then you have a dropdown.
And right now it says remember history, I think is the default.
The default is just remember everything. You also have the choice to remember nothing, or you can say use custom settings for history, which is what I would highly recommend.
Okay.
And then you get a bunch of checkboxes, which allows you to remember your browsing history for at least 90 days, which sounds like a reasonable thing to do.
Yeah.
Remember your download history. Sounds reasonable. Then there's a checkbox, remember search and forum history. That's the one you uncheck.
Ah. Okay.
And then while you're here, there's also a checkbox to say accept cookies, and below that, accept third-party cookies.
Ooh, and you want to turn those off, don't you?
You want to turn off your third-party cookies while you're here anyway.
Isn't that the ones we talked about last week, about like the double-click ones?
Yeah, the third-party ones, you really, really need first-party cookies for the internet to work, but the third-party ones are a good idea to turn off.
Okay. All right,
so
good.
Just while you're here.
So I'm
and I say, I have no idea how it works now.
I'm going to put images of the three of these in the show notes so people can see it.
Oh. Excellent.
I brought them all up one at a time, and they're all over my screen now. Good thing I have so much screen real estate to find them all. All right, good. So now we could avoid all this just by using NoScript, couldn't we, Bart?
Yeah, absolutely. I was afraid to mention it, but yes, because this is yet another JavaScript-based attack.
I'm not going to do it. So if at some point in the history we're allowed to have this back and you remember, will you tell us?
If I remember and if the browser companies are clear about it.
Okay, yeah, they'd have to do some work.
They'd have to stop JavaScript being able to read what the browser auto-populates somehow.
Right.
I'm not sure how easy that'll be, but we have smart people.
Yeah. Okay. Well, is that it?
I think that's everything we technically forgot. just totally, this occurred to me about 10 minutes before we started recording. Remember last week we were saying how the Mac had a bright future?
Yeah.
Three guesses when the Mac had its best ever quarter.
Just now.
This one!
Yeah, that's a good point. They showed, 30-some-odd% growth?
Yeah, 4.4 million in revenue. Or was it billion? 4.4 or something anyway.
Squillion.
Lots.
Big fat piles of money. I was kind of disappointed, though, to see that Microsoft's earnings came in and their revenue actually was slightly above Apple's.
Well, they can't keep winning forever. Apple are catching up, that's the thing. It wasn't this time.
They just barely. I think they were around $16 billion and Apple was at $15.5 billion or some numbers on that order. But, another half a billion to go.
It was close. But I'm sure it'll swap over next time. I just thought it was hilarious that everyone was writing the story as if it was certain.
Right.
And then the results came out and it was like, oh, shoot, Microsoft actually did better than we thought.
That's okay. That time will pass.
Exactly.
All right, Bart. Well, I'm not quite sure how we sign off.
See you in a bit.
All right. Sounds good. Bye, Bart.
Bye-bye.
This week, I was encoding some video, and as always seems to happen, the video I did last week looked great, and the one I was doing this week was a complete mess. I opened them both up in QuickTime, and I opened the QuickTime properties so I could look at the first video and see how it was encoded and switch to the other one. First one was H.264 video, AAC audio. I'm looking at frame rates and bit rates and all that. Then I flipped to the other video, and the properties menu switched to the second videos. Dagnabbit, well, what did the first one say now? Here I am flipping back and forth, and with the memory of a common housefly, I could not figure out what was different between them. I thought, okay, no problem, I'll just do a screen capture of them with Jing and open the snapshots side by side. But you know what? When you try to do that, QuickTime fades the properties menu. But wait, I have another tool in my arsenal that came to my rescue, and it's ScreenSteps. You see, while ScreenSteps is primarily a documentation tool for writing complex manuals and lessons, it happens to come with a fantastic built-in screen capture utility that does timed captures. All I had to do was set it to, say, 4 seconds, Click the capture button, go over to the QuickTime, and wait until ScreenStep's capture froze the image, and then I could snap away. In just a few seconds, I'd captured both my properties menus into a single document so I could go back and study them. Sadly, I still haven't figured out what's wrong with my videos. I sure wish the ScreenSteps guys actually did video encoding tools too, because then it would be easy to do. If you'd like this great tool in your arsenal to solve interesting documentation problems, head over to ScreenSteps.com and be sure to use my coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, for 25% off the purchase price of ScreenSteps Desktop. Good friend of the show, Ian Princen, has, with a friend of his, created an iPhone app I wanted to review. Of course, we must start with a problem to be solved. One of Ian's three sons was really scared of monsters in his room. Ian thought, what if I could create an app that scans a room for monsters, and if it finds any, it scares them away with a scary sound? Well, that's exactly what Ian and his friend Manny Flores have done. They call their app Go Away Monster 3000. That's not just regular Go Away Monster. Make sure you get the 3000 model. That's way better. When you first launch Go Away Monster 3000, it shows you a screen with a radar-like grid with three small buttons underneath: launch, scan, and scare. Scan is the first step you want to take. Click that button and waves go out to search the surrounding area for dreaded monsters. If you try Go Away Monster 3000 at night, you won't find any monsters because the main point is for the kid not to find them, so he's not scared. To allow your adventure to be more fun, go into the iPhone preferences and scroll down to the apps area. Click on Go Away Monster 3000. In there, you can change the start and end time for monsters to be available, so if your child does want to find monsters at night, they can. And you can also set the probability that a monster will be found. You can change the scan duration and choose from three different sounds to scare away the monsters, or keep it set to randomly choose from those three sounds. Now, I'd like to see these settings inside the app instead of over in preferences, because I had never thought to look there. I actually found Ian online, and I was able to find out where the preferences were. I guess a lot of apps are starting to do it that way, and somebody told me that actually that's the way Apple wants you to do it, but it never occurred to me to go over there to change the preferences. Okay, now that we've got our pref set to actually find monsters, it gets really cute. Click on launch, and when you find a monster, you can either scare it right away, or you can choose launch, which brings it up on full screen, and then the monster spins away. The graphics are just beautiful. They're kind of like that toy Color Forms, bright colors with shading to make it look like these two-dimensional monsters are kind of jumping out of the page. They're just adorable. Go Away Monster 3000 will cost you a total of 99 cents for your iPhone. And while it comes stocked with 12 monsters already, they're working on more. If you have any little kids in your life, this is sure to be a hit as they go around scanning their rooms, your room, restaurants, the train station bathroom for monsters. Check out Go Away Monster 3000 at goawaymonster.com and be sure to click on the link for our staff to learn more about the officers of this fine company. A couple of weeks ago, I complained about how the Flickr uploader in Aperture 3 had some aspects that really annoyed me. I know, I'm always whining about Flickr anyway, and Aperture 3 has been such a dog, I don't say much good about it either, but I keep banging away on those things to try to make them work. The good news is that Aperture 3 came with a built-in Flickr uploader, instead of having to use some dodgy plugin or other third-party tool, or exporting the files to your desktop and then back up to Flickr. The bad news was that if I used the Flickr uploader, I couldn't upload to an existing set. It doesn't give you a choice of existing sets, and if you use the identical naming of an existing set, it creates another set of the same name with an index number next to it, like Tesla drive, test drive, parentheses 1. Well, I'm 100% certain that someone wrote to me either in a comment on the blog or in a direct email, or maybe it was a tweet, telling me the right way to do it so this problem doesn't occur. But for the life of me, I cannot remember who it was. The good news is that a bit later, Donald Burr of Otaku No Podcast actually made a screencast video for us illustrating exactly how to do it wrong, clearly my preferred method, and how to do it right. I'm embedding the video in the show notes, so if you're interested in watching it, you can learn the right way to do it. The basic idea is that you actually create the original sets inside Aperture 3 and then drag more photos into the set from there instead of naming it. The problem is that I have a whole bunch of existing sets up there already that I add to, like cars I have waxed. So I'd have to move all the photos into a set created by Aperture to get this idea to work. If I'm starting from scratch on a new set, though, that's definitely how I'm going to do it. You know what? Now that I think about it, I wonder if it was George from Tulsa who said that, who told me. Oh, I wish I could remember. It's making me crazy. Great news. Right while I'm recording, George from Tulsa is in the chat room, and it was George from Tulsa who told me how to do it. All right, good. Now I can rest easy.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
How do I? What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, Zach asks, what's a pivot table and what problem does it solve? Well, I've talked about pivot tables pretty extensively in the past, but it's been ages since I spent much time on them. And since it's one of my favorite subjects, I thought I'd take this one on. Let's answer this kind of in reverse order, starting with what problem it solves first. Let's say you've got a massive spreadsheet with tons of data in it. You want to make that data into information, which is completely different, right? That's a whole nother thing. Let's say this data is all of your customers with their locations and sales data by month. If you wanted to see an aggregate view of this, say, how does your sales vary month to month? That might be a good use for a pivot table. If you could see that, you could start working on pushing sales during the low months, or maybe plan your vacations during those months since you don't make much money then anyway. You could easily do a sum at the bottom of the spreadsheet and see the total sales each month, no pivot table required. But what if you wanted to know this information by region too? How could you do that? How would you see the information in those two dimensions? That's where the magical pivot table comes in and saves the day. The first thing you have to know is that for every column of data you want to include in the pivot table, you must have a column heading. In fact, you can't leave a blank column heading and just use a column to the right of it. So you have to have, if you have a column you don't care about, just make sure there's some stupid heading in there, even if it's just gibberish. Once you've got your data in good shape, you can start the pivot table. I'm not going to walk through all of the steps of this because I do have a tutorial posted in the tutorial section at podfeet.com that shows you how to get started. Here's the gist of what you do, though. You basically drag some column titles into the left side of the pivot table. You drag some into the bottom of the pivot table. And if it's a complex issue, some can even go into the top row of the pivot table. What happens next is the real magic. Let's say we drag the month name into the left column, and then the month name again into the body. The titles of the month will show up on the left, and the body defaults to the sum of the values for that month, which is actually what we want. So you'd see January, February, March down the left-hand column, and the sum of sales by month would be in the body of the table. But this again is what we could easily get with sums at the bottom of the month column, right? No big magic yet. But now, drag the region names into the top row of the pivot table, and suddenly you've got the sum by month by region. Now, this would take hours and hours of effort if you had to do it by hand, writing statements like, if parentheses month equal Jan, comma, then sum, colon, you know, A1, colon, 1256, else, you know, all that kind of nonsense. Instead, you've got this table made instantly. Once you get the hang of pivot tables by simply playing with them, they're an incredibly efficient way to take gobs of meaningless data and turn it into human-readable information. I hope that explanation helps, Zach. We have another dumb question, and this one was a puzzler. Brian in Vegas asks, "Hello, Allison. First off, great podcast. I've been enjoying your show for quite a while now, and I've always wanted to join in. So I've got a dumb question to add to your collection. I've been doing things on the Windows side for years. We bought our first Mac maybe 6 years ago, and soon after that I was hooked. Most things I've been able to figure out either by trying and failing or by learning from others, like you and your peeps. Here's the question. In the Windows world, if I pick an item to delete, a dialog box will pop up with a confirm file delete box for me to check. Now I can press the return key, as you refer to it, to make my selection, yes, or if I change my mind, I can either use the arrows or the tab key to select the other option. No. When I do this on the Mac, how do I use my keyboard to toggle my selection? I've tried several key combinations with no success. Thanks for the work you do in producing the show." Well, for 5 days, I searched for an answer to this question. I tried everything I could think of on OS X. I tested what Brian described on Windows 7, even. I took it to work and tested it there. Finally, I tweeted it, And Ryan Gray, Buddy Brannon, and Barry Folk all came through with a secret key. Now, several others told me it could be done, but didn't give me the exact directions. Only those three guys gave it to me straight up. Thanks for the crowdsourcing help, everyone. Now I'll try to look like I'm the smart one. Here's the trick, Brian. Everybody knows this. If you want to be able to toggle between all of the controls on the Mac, open up System Preferences and open the Keyboard Preference pane. Then click the Keyboard Shortcuts tab. On the bottom part of the preference pane, there's a radio button to change full keyboard access in windows and dialogues. If you change it from the default of text boxes and lists only to all controls, you'll be able to press tab to move the focus between any controls. I tested this out, and sure enough, I can toggle with a tab between cancel and OK on cancel and empty trash. While this is exactly what you asked for, this comes at a price. You'll find now that hitting tab won't go where you expect it to. For example, with all controls selected, open up your web browser, put the cursor in the URL field, and hit tab. It's going to jump to the search window, which is fine, but if you hit another tab, it's going to go to each of your bookmarks in your bookmarks bar. I was hoping this might be a feature that you could tab to a bookmark and in the bookmarks bar and then hit enter and it would open the bookmark, but that didn't work. If you do tab to a bookmarks folder in the bookmarks bar, you can arrow down and then select a bookmark to open with the Enter key, but that sure seems like a lot of work. I changed the controls back as soon as I got done writing this up because it drove me nuts. Well, today Honda Bob stopped by for a visit, and he wanted to show me his new horn he put in his car. He likes to use air horns because they have a much more dramatic effect when he wants someone out of his way. First, he showed me the push button he put under the hood. I'm not quite sure why he has one under the hood. But he even let me blow the horns, which was a lot of fun. He wanted me to see the horns, so he encouraged me to lay down on the ground, put my head under the car where they're mounted, just inside the front wheel. Of course, you know what happened next. He blew that horn right in my ear. Thanks. I should have known he was going to do this. He plays this trick on me in some way just about every time I see him, but I keep falling for it. Why do I put up with this kind of tomfoolery? Because he's the best darn Honda mechanic in all of Los Angeles. That's why. He's the only person I trust with maintenance and repair of our cars. If you live in the LA or Orange County areas and you drive a Honda or an Acura, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or shoot him an email over at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchotts from BartB.ie. There, I got it.
Not Bart B from BartBouchotts.ie. Wait, no.
That cracked Steve up when I couldn't remember how to introduce you. Your name is now BartB.ie.
Some people think that anyway.
There you go. Well, we got a packed show. We've been talking for a half hour just getting ready for the show because we have so much to talk about. Let's kick right in. How about Security Light, Bart?
Okay, so the first one is, I've decided I don't generally want to talk about every browser update because there's too many of them and they all do it automatically anyway. But I figure I'll just mention that if any of the Mozilla products, be that Firefox, SeaMonkey, or Thunderbird, ask you to let them update themselves, it's probably a good idea to do it promptly because there's a couple of serious ones been patched.
You know, I tried to do it on my Windows 7 box for Firefox, and it went off, and it got to 100% of the thing downloaded, and it kept saying it was downloading it indefinitely. Oh. So I quit the browser and I reopened it and it said, right, I was downloading that. I don't know what to do. I'll probably reboot or something and see if I can try it again, but it would not do it.
Oh, well, worst comes to worst, go to Firefox.com and download a fresh copy and install it over itself.
Oh, that's a good idea. Okay, good.
Yeah, and then another one, which is a bizarre one, Apple have released an update to iTunes, which is a security update.
Really?
Yep, it's for both Mac and Windows, and in some ways, we should now point and laugh at Apple as much as we point and laughed at Microsoft, because it's a problem with URL schemes.
Oh, really?
In this case, it's IPTC:URLs, which are used by the iTunes Store.
Right, if you ever do a link to a specific podcast, for example, you see it as ITPC, right?
Yep. So handling of those can allow arbitrary code execution, just like the Windows one that we made so much fun of for Windows Help a couple of weeks ago.
Darn! So let it update?
Let it update.
Actually, I don't know that iTunes nags you as much as it should.
iTunes doesn't really... No, iTunes doesn't nag you very much at all, but actual OS X update will nag you.
Yeah, it does. It's not like they don't do it when it first comes out, though, as it might be 3 or 4 days till you see it. Yeah,
I think it's once a week. I think you can set that, though. So if you want to be nagged more often, you can. You can go into System Preferences and Software Update. And then you can choose, I think.
How often
so check for updates so you can have weekly, daily, or monthly. Don't set it to monthly. Whatever you do, don't set it to monthly.
Yeah, really. I think mine's set to weekly, it looks like. But I know the iTunes updates for the iPhone and the iPad, I mean, you can plug in your iPhone every day of the week and it won't tell you that there's an update unless you go click on that tab that talks about updates. You have to go look for it. It doesn't come up and go, hey, I've got 9.0.7.6.2 ready for you.
That's funny because I plugged my iPad in the other day and it went, hello, here's an update you wanted. And then I plugged in my iPhone and it went, and here's one for you too.
Nope. Plugged mine in today, plugged mine in every day this week. Haven't seen anything.
Wow.
And I know there's an iPad firmware update. It has not. Now, I haven't plugged the iPad in recently, but...
You should do that, actually, because that's a fairly important update, too, from a couple of weeks ago now. Or
right.
From last week. No, it's from last week, so it's not too bad. But you should do it.
All right, what else we got?
Okay, so then another one. We have a story here, and to some extent, I blame the media for taking this one out of all proportions, and another extent, I blame the security company for talking rubbish. But you will have heard news outlets say that Apple is now officially the most insecure software maker in the world.
Yes, they passed Oracle.
Yeah, now...
Which is weird, because nobody ever talks about
metric.
Oracle.
This is a pathetic metric. Just count the number of vulnerabilities we know about. Doesn't matter how quickly you patch them, doesn't matter how serious they are, we just add them up. It's utter... It's garbage. It's a garbage metric that actually means nothing. So... That's not a particularly useful number. Having said that, I still think Apple should patch more and more quickly, but I'd say that anyway.
Right.
This number doesn't really change anything. What is interesting in the report, because obviously that number made the headlines because it's always fun to do that. You know, these big things make big news, even if they're useless, pointless bits of statistical playing. It's people having too much fun with Excel rather than telling us anything useful. But there is actually some interesting stuff in here, which is that they've been tracking a shift since about the year 2000, where in the year 2000, the vast bulk of vulnerabilities were in the actual core operating systems. And now there's been a massive shift towards third-party apps. So things like QuickTime, Flash, Acrobat... even the Java runtime, those kind of things, those are now being attacked far more often than the actual core operating systems. So OS X isn't actually doing too bad in terms of vulnerabilities.
Oh, but it's saying if you're running Java on OS X or QuickTime on OS X, that's where the vulnerabilities are?
Yeah, and on Windows it's the same. So if for their metrics, they use Windows machines with the 50 most common apps installed, and then they start counting up the vulnerabilities.
Mm.
And 70% of those vulnerabilities, I think it said, are from third-party stuff, not from the operating system. So really, people are now being exposed by Adobe, and they get to expose everyone.
So this is bad news for people like me that load every single thing that ever comes across their Twitter feed?
It's, to be honest, it's getting to the point where I would suggest playing with apps either on a dedicated machine where you have nothing of any value or in a VM.
Yeah, if I could have a Mac OS VM, that would be fun, but I can't.
Apparently you could with certain versions of VirtualBox. I know Justin talked about it on the MacRack podcast.
Oh, interesting.
But that was experimental support and it lasted one version.
Oh, well, I know I can run OS 8.5 on my Mac here with Sheepshaver, so I got that going for me.
Yeah, and that'll help you test modern apps out.
Well, I didn't see modern apps, but all right. Yeah. So, what should we do? Not do anything about that. We just kind of go.
To be honest, I just mentioned it because I know for a fact it's going to have people going, "Ha ha, told you so."
So, I'm not sure I completely understand how to defend why it's stupid, though.
It's just taking the total number of vulnerabilities without taking in any account of how much risk they actually pose to people. That's not a real metric.
So if you
arguably
took high
you
risk,
can say Apple is too good at telling us what they fixed, because by that metric, the simple thing to do is to just shut up and say nothing. And then you're the most secure company because look at how few vulnerabilities there are.
Okay.
just counting vulnerabilities without giving them, you know, what impact do they have? How hard are they to exploit? How likely are they to be exploited? How much danger do they actually pose to you as a person using a computer? And if you take that kind of stuff into account, the Mac is still the safest. Whether or not it's arguably more or less vulnerable according to some statistics isn't what really matters. It's safer because less stuff hits you and kills you.
That's catastrophic, you mean?
Yeah. I mean, there are now some Microsoft bits or some Apple bits of malware out there. But compared to the Windows world, we're still in a very safe little suburb rather than, you know, in the middle of a dangerous city.
Now, is it a true statement that there's still no self-replicating virus for the Mac? Something that if you get it, you then pass it to everybody in your address book kind of a thing?
As far as I know, there's officially one, which is the one that spread itself through iChat, which is arguably not really self-replicating.
Okay.
But...
because I've been telling people there still isn't anything, that there are vulnerabilities, but not self-replicating vulnerabilities. You have to take some action.
There's nothing doing the rounds in the real world.
Okay.
That's self-replicating in the traditional Windows virus kind of sense. Okay. There's a whole bunch of Trojan horses. But that's it.
Right. But in general, you have to take some action on your own part to go get those, right? You have to go to a dodgy
site. Well,
yeah,
that Trojan horse is a piece of software that says it's a wallpaper or a screensaver and is actually a keylogger stealing all your bank details.
Right, but it doesn't doesn't then give it to all of your friends, which is why one of the reasons Microsoft gets hit so badly is that it's self-replicating, so all of a sudden you're emailing it to all your buddies and they're all downloading it too.
Yeah, or it's spreading through Windows file shares, or it's infecting every floppy disk you put into the machine, and then you give the floppy disk to a friend and it infects the machine, and then that machine infects every floppy disk, because that was the way viruses used to spread before we all had internet access. So every disk that went into the machine would be infected, and every machine that disk into would become infected. And you really, really quickly spread like wildfire that way.
I guess, who was it, Dell this week that discovered that they had a virus in the BIOS of the motherboards they were shipping?
Well, yeah, but on server motherboards, there is so much happening on board that this doesn't come as even the tiniest bit of a shock. There's like an entire operating system in those motherboards on servers because you can actually log into the motherboard and tell the machine to boot itself.
Oh, right.
So they think they're network connected. Yeah, so this was a yoke that put itself into the BIOS and then installed Windows spyware into every OS that booted on the damn thing.
So if you had a server and you had a motherboard go out, you ask Dell to ship you a new one and they sent you one and all of a sudden you've got it. That's just, oh. That makes my blood run cold.
No, when that report came out, there was a sprint to the server room looking at the model numbers on our Dells.
Oh, that's right.
Because it was the R410s that were affected, and we had no R410s. So, yay!
happy day. What a mess. Yeah. All right, well, can we go on to more fun stuff now? We've eaten our vegetables. Let's get on to some toys.
Okay, so we take up our story, as it were. This is something I started at the start of the year-ish. Where I had a bad run-in with the next version of Cha-Ching, and I didn't like that it was being pushed on their site as being ready for use. They call it beta, but it's the only version that's available for download. You know, it's the one they put front and center.
Mm-hmm.
And again, and it's buggy as hell.
Quickly, Cha-Ching is a finance app.
It's a personal finance app.
For anybody who wasn't here when Bart talked about choosing Cha-Ching in the first place.
Which is even longer ago.
Right.
Probably 2 years ago even, if not more. Because I did use Cha-Ching for a couple of years, and I was quite happy with Cha-Ching 1. And then at the start of the year, I went to OS X Snow Leopard on my MacBook Pro and decided to do a clean install, as I like to do. And, you know, and I like to download my apps afresh when I do that. And I went to download Cha-Ching, and I was like, oh, cool, Cha-Ching 2 is the one that they're telling everyone to download now. Great, I'll do that. And it just ate everything for its lunch.
The idea of the word beta and my money in the same sentence makes me a little nervous.
Well, yeah, but you would imagine that whatever... I mean, Google have sullied that word to the point that it has no actual meaning.
Right.
So my theory is whatever they put in the biggest letters is the one they're telling you to download.
Right.
And if they make you look really hard to find the old 1.0 version, that's probably not the one they're expecting you to download.
Makes sense.
But didn't work like that on Cha-Ching. It made a complete pig's ear of all my accounts. Thankfully, I had done a full backup, so I rolled back to Cha-Ching 1 and got everything back. I sent them an email to support and never got an answer.
And that would be the wrong answer.
That would be the wrongest possible answer. There's nothing they could have said that would have been worse than not answering at all.
Right.
So that was it. I'd had enough. I was like, I'm sorry, but you're pushing complete buggy junk as if it's your most up-to-date version. Now, arguably, they're still calling it beta, so it's my fault. But on the other hand, if you make it the biggest font and put it front and center, surely I'm not being unreasonable.
Yeah.
And not answering my support email is a big no-no.
Yeah, that's, I don't like that's being pretty taken. Much game over.
Yeah, I've given you my money. I now expect to get a service in return. I don't expect to be taken for granted because you already have my money. It rubs me up the wrong way so much when a company I have paid to have a relationship with ignores me.
Right.
So I was cranky and I said, that's it, I'm leaving.
So a new quest was begun.
A new quest was begun, and the theory was I'd want to do this fairly quickly so I don't have too much catch-up to do, because I'd rounded out my accounts for the financial... In Ireland, the financial year and the calendar year end at the same time, which means that in January I had just finished the accounts for 2009, so it was the perfect time to switch to new software. So I said, I better not wait too long, or I'm going to have a lot of catching up to do.
Right.
I didn't do too well at that. 2 weeks ago, I finally... made a purchase. So before, early in the year, I had sort of narrowed it down to a couple of favorite options and gone through them and sort of picked a favorite, but it wasn't entirely happy with it. So I said I'd wait a while, and then Quicken Essentials was due out, and I said I'll wait to see what that turns out to be. And then Quicken decided not to give a free trial, which is the other way to make me not give you any money.
Right.
If you're not confident enough in your software to give me a free trial, I'm not interested. Because, you know, that to me, that just reeks of where we don't have confidence.
I think that's something we've come to assume in the Mac world and is really missing in the iPad, iPhone world, just because there isn't any way to do it through iTunes. But I really like the free trial option.
To me, it's essential. What Quicken's do is they give you a money-back guarantee, but it's not a cheap product, and I'm not going to hand over my money and then have to beg you for it back if I don't like the product. It works the other way around. You know, the customer is always right, etc.
Yeah.
So I didn't even try, mainly because I don't particularly like the company anyway. I've had a couple of run-ins with their Windows products.
And they left us for a while. They abandoned us for a long time, too.
There is a lot of bad blood in the Mac community as a whole, I think it's fair to say, against Intuit.
But the nice thing is there's a lot of options out there now.
There is a lot of options. So I had already looked at the options, and then I waited a couple of months, and I looked at the options again, and 2 weeks ago I made a decision. I went, ta-ta, I am choosing Squirrel. It was only $20, and it was a nice Mac-like app, nice, simple, intuitive UI, seemed to do everything I wanted. So I said, yeah, that's fine. I'm going to put my money where my mouth is, and I'm going to buy this app. And I had actually done 25 test transactions, and it was flawless. Mm-hmm. And pretty much from the instant I stuck in my registration code, it went terribly, horribly pear-shaped.
Oh, no.
I ran into bug after bug, and one of them is, I can honestly say, the most infuriating bug I have ever come across. I swore like a trooper. The autofill buffer gets corrupted, and something gets stuck in it, which is something you've entered previously in some previous transaction. In my case, it was Register 365, which is a company I buy domains from. And no matter what you type, I was trying to type a number into the number field, and I typed 41 and got or E.
Huh?
And then if I typed, yeah, no matter what you type, whatever it gets stuck in its autofill buffer is what comes out. So I could type anything and Register 365 is what would come out. Be it numbers, be it text.
Oh,
and you could hit backspace and do it again, and exactly the same thing would happen. And it would keep happening until you turn off the app and turn it back on again.
Oh, jeez.
I swear.
And then it would get filled up again.
And then you'd maybe get another 20 transactions in, and then it would happen again.
So it's something you could never have found in your 25 test transactions.
I guess I was lucky, because I did 5 or 6 of them, put it away, tried a few other apps, came back to it, did another couple just to be sure. I'd never really used it for half an hour on end because I was investigating loads of apps. I didn't have infinite time.
Sure.
So I just did a couple. Has that feature. Okay, went to another one. What about this one? Oh, doesn't have that feature. I like that better. Went back. You know, I was going forward and back between my 4 options. Had them all installed and was, you know, changing my mind constantly and going back and forth. And it worked fine. So that made me cranky. And I wrote an email to the developer and I said, look, I've just run into the most infuriating bug. And unlike Cha-Ching, I got a really quick answer, which made me say, okay, this is a bad bug, but at least the developer is responsive, right, friendly, and I thought, I'll try again. So the developer came back and said, yeah, I'm aware of that bug. It's going to be fixed in the next version. I'm doing an iPhone app for the next version too, and I can't release the next version until the iPhone app's ready, and the iPhone app's not ready yet. So it's going to be a while, but it is going to be patched. And I thought to myself, it's going to be awkward for a while. So I wrote back and I said, how long's a while? And he said, at least September.
I said, okay. You dearly, but can I wait that long?
Because he had been so responsive and so friendly, I mean, I had a conversation with him within the space of one evening. You know, a few emails over and back, no waiting days for a reply. So I said, the next day I woke up and I said, okay, I do actually like the app. And he was responsive. So I'm going to try again. I'm going to do another couple. And that's when I hit the next bug. And that one really just compounds the first one. Because of this bug, you regularly end up with transactions that have to be edited because they're full of garbage.
Oh, right.
Not every time, but whenever this bug kicks in, when you edit a transaction and you hit save, the description gets saved to two transactions, not just the one you edited. Oh. So another random one will change. So you have an inability to edit, and every time you edit, you make two problems. So one problem becomes two problems, become four problems, become eight problems. After very short order, half of my transactions were garbage.
Oh, jeez.
So I wrote another email. I'd also asked him the first one, what's the story with getting your money back? And he said, well, if you're not happy, I'll issue you a refund. That's not a problem. And because he was so quick to offer to say, yeah, that's fine, I'll give you your money back, I was even more inclined to try again. Because he ticked all the boxes of this guy isn't taking me for granted, this guy is responsive, this guy is helpful. And to be honest, it's a small company. I think it may be just him, in fact.
Right.
And I like supporting small companies, and I know he's working hard in it, and he was very receptive to ideas for improvements I'd sent him before in January when I was first experimenting with this stuff. So I really did want to give him a second try. But anyway, I wrote back and said, I've just run into a second, even worse bug. And he wrote back and said, oh yeah, no, but that one too. And I said, okay, these are so serious. How can you possibly
take money
not
for
patch
it?
This till September
yeah.
and keep taking people's money? And I said to him, look, I see a lot of promise in your app. I'm really happy with the way you respond to customers. And I'm going to take you up on that offer for my money back if you don't mind. But I, no matter how much I like your responsiveness,
I can't use your software.
I said to him outright, I said, I think it's deeply immoral that you keep selling this.
Mm. Like maybe put it on hiatus, say, I can't finish yeah. this. I can't fix this until September.
Or do a bug release to the previous version and, you know, backport your fixes to the last version or whatever. But and there's a million and one right answers. But keeping selling something you know has two such serious bugs, that's the wrong answer.
Yeah, I mean, and putting the iPhone app as a priority order over making the one you're selling work, that doesn't seem like a good priority call.
It really doesn't. And obviously he's had a couple of other complaints. I imagine that's why he was so quick to say, if you want your money back, no problem.
Yeah.
Now, that's only a guess, of course. I don't know that, but that certainly strikes me that way.
Right.
I can't imagine I was the first person to say, excuse me, refund, plix. But as I say, he did give it to me.
That's good.
He was responsive. He was friendly. Now, so if someone else tries the next version first, I might yet give it a go. But I won't be a guinea pig next time.
Right. Now, you've been crowdsourcing your search, right? You've been asking people for advice.
Twitter very, very much was my friend on this one. So I had initially narrowed it down to four, which was Moneywell, Moneydance, Squirrel, and iBank. And that was back at the start of the year. But in the meantime, through comments on the blog and through Twitter, people have been sending me other suggestions as they happen. And the product I finally chose after the disaster with Squirrel, so I got my money back and I went, okay, now I'm back to bleeding square one. But Connor P., one of our listeners and also a regular IMP'er, suggested another app that hadn't been on my initial shortlist called Money3 from a company called Jumsoft. I've never heard of them. I presume you pronounce it Jumsoft. It's Jumsoft.
Yeah.
And I hadn't actually heard of it before. It wasn't on my previous shortlist, but I downloaded it because I had a free trial, and I was instantly impressed.
I'm looking at the website. It's beautiful. That is a really pretty app.
I mean, Cha-Ching was always pretty and playful, but to be honest, it was a bit of a toy because it spent too much time being cuddly and friendly and not enough time actually being a personal finance app.
Mm-hmm.
So Money is still pretty, but it's a little more serious and a little less of a toy. So that's good. So it did everything I wanted, and I did about 50 test transactions. No, actually, it's probably close to 100. I actually did and I did a lot. I did an entire month's worth of data before I even considered paying for anything after the disaster with Squirrel. But I did pay for it, and that was about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. And since then, I've gotten completely up to date. I've entered every transaction in my 6 accounts between January the 1st and now, and it has behaved like an absolute champ.
Oh, nice.
I'm going to touch wood when I say this. I have yet to see a single bug. I found the workflow to be friendly, intuitive, easy. I didn't have to check the manual once. It has the important features I want. It has really good transfer support between sending money from one account to another, which is something that Cha-Ching just didn't do, and something that Squirrel got a bit buggy with on occasion.
Got squirrely with it?
Got a bit squirrely with it, yeah.
It's a cool name, though.
It is a cool name, and there's a lot to like about Squirrel. If you just look at it on paper, it's the perfect product. Reality, unfortunately, misses at the moment. So, you know, good transaction support. It actually links the two transactions together when you do a transfer. So if you're doing it in Cha-Ching, in Cha-Ching 1, Cha-Ching 2 has actually had a transfer support, but because of, I'm not going back there. So if you add a transfer, it's not two separate transactions like it was in Cha-Ching, where you'd make a withdrawal from one and a deposit into the other, and if you changed one, it wouldn't affect the other. They're actually linked transactions, so if you edit one, you've edited both sides of it. And there's actually a little arrow to show that it is a transfer, and when you click on the arrow, it takes you to the other transaction in the other account.
Oh, that's kind of neat.
And the direction of the arrow shows whether the money's coming or going, which is nice.
Hmm.
So good transfer for support. Another thing which sounds silly, but Cha-Ching didn't have it, is a running total down the side. Sounds really trivial, but it didn't have it. And that makes it so much easier to reconcile stuff with your statements, because your statements have a running total too.
Right.
And you know exactly where you went wrong is at the point when the running total on the piece of paper and the running total on your screen don't agree anymore. That's where your error is, and you fix it.
I have to ask you, you know, my daughter is great at questioning the status quo. And I was taught by my mommy when I was 18 years old, got my first checking account, that you get your bank statement and you save up all your little receipts and your check registers, your canceled checks, and you go through and you write them all down and you do a running total. And at the end, you go through and you reconcile all of that, checking it off onto your statement. And then at the end of every single month, I go back and I change everything I did because they did it right and I made mistakes throughout the month because I can't subtract. And I did that for 30 years. Now, one day my daughter goes, "Why do you do it?" I said, "Well, you know, because you're supposed to." And she goes, "Why?"
Okay. My case, there's a couple of reasons.
Okay. Twice in that 30-year period, they were wrong. At least 5 times a month, I was wrong. So, there was one time where they showed that I took $100 out of one ATM, and I walked to the one right next to it, and I took out another $100. I'm thinking, why would I have done that? I mean, I don't have any record of it. And I went in, and I mentioned it to the bank, and they went, okay, no problem, and they took it right off. So, I saved $100 once, and I spent 75,000 hours correcting my checkbook. So, that day that she said it, I stopped checking them.
Okay, well, I wouldn't say that I do that. The nice thing in the electronic age is that you don't have to keep receipts and stuff. Well, I don't anyway. I certainly don't bother checking whether the grocery store overcharged me by a cent. I couldn't be arsed. But what I do want to do is, okay. For a start, I also have my own sort of private consultancy gig going. So I have to pay tax and stuff on that, and I'd like not to end up in prison. So that's a really good reason to do
your accounts
properly.
It's so funny that
way. Yeah, strange, I know. Now this is Ireland, and our tax enforcement isn't the best, but I'm not going to take a chance.
Right.
So that's one reason I simply have to do accounts anyway. But on top of that, there's also the fact that what I'm interested in isn't finding that little place where the supermarket overcharged me by a cent, where my receipt said €34.06, and they charged me €34.07. I'm not interested in that. What I'm interested in is...
I would spend hours finding that penny.
Yeah, the only thing I found, because it was an invoice relating to the work, to the business stuff, is a company which invoiced me for an extra €2.90. Sorry, they took €2.90 they hadn't invoiced me for.
Mm.
Which I started making a big deal out of, and then I went, it's €2.90. Saw that.
Yeah, right.
But no, to me, the most important thing is to categorize everything so that you have some sort of idea where your money's going, and so that you know, because these are troubled times, and I don't want to go into too much personal detail, but we were a two-income family, and now we're not, and that makes things difficult.
Right.
So the important thing to know is, how much do we actually need to survive? How much do we spend on groceries? How much do we spend on energy bills? How much do we spend on transportation? And then how much do we spend on fluffy stuff that is nice to have, but if push comes to shove, we can do without? And if you don't know what that answer is, you don't see trouble coming.
Right. And if you measure things, you tend to control them. It's like if you measure your caloric intake, you don't eat as much as if you don't measure it. Simply measuring it causes you to pay attention.
So what I'm interested in doing is categorizing the expenses. And when you're forced to categorize them, you're forced to admit to yourself things like, you know, I really can't put this down as a necessity because it is a luxury. No matter how much I want that new whatever, it is in fact a luxury. And you're forced to be a little honest with yourself. And, you know, you see month by month, like, for example, I've changed the supermarket I go to and it's had a really marked effect on the monthly grocery bill.
Oh,
it's gone down by about 20%.
Wow. That's but if you hadn't been measuring it, you wouldn't know that.
You know, anecdotally, I might have thought, yeah, that cat food is a bit cheaper. But on the whole, it doesn't. You don't quite get the big picture on these things. So now I know exactly how much money is the bottom line. And I know exactly the point to start panicking when, you know, income goes under the bare minimum. Thankfully, that point hasn't arrived. But it also tells me how much I have to spend on tech and stuff, because that's the difference between bare minimum and what I actually have.
Hmm.
Then the other thing, so that's definitely useful. The other thing, of course, is to, because this thing allows you to specify future, or not just future, but scheduled expenses. So it doesn't come as a complete surprise to you when the annual renewal for the house insurance suddenly creeps up and you'd completely forgotten that that happened in June.
I'd like to say that we've never forgotten that was coming, but
I use that example because only 2 weeks ago I forgot that was coming, and that's why I've now remembered I really need to get back to doing my accounts.
Yeah.
You know, it drops through the letterbox like, oh, look, a bill for
Exactly.
So that's definitely good. And also your monthly ones. It's nice actually just be able to look and say, okay, so the TV, you know, the bill for internet is coming on the 24th, the bill for the phone is coming on the 25th, and the cell phone bill is coming on the 28th, and then there's nothing else coming this month until after my paycheck. It's like, okay, so I can spend all of my money apart from this bit.
On Mac toys.
On Mac toys, yeah.
So back to Money 3, that's really helping you to be able to see that?
Yes. Yes, it is. It's support for bills I really like, because you can basically, it's been pretty much, in fact, a lot of ways it reminds me of iCal, because you can have your basic monthly, annually, bi-monthly, biannually, those kind of normal things. But you can also sort of say custom and say, I just want this to happen on the 1st of February, the 1st of July, and the 1st of April, if you'd want to. So you can really get quite silly with these things. Thankfully, most bills are annual or monthly anyway.
Now, can you schedule things like, I got to remember to bill my customers, that sort of thing, for your business side?
There is another tab where you can specify invoices and things.
Hmm.
I haven't started using that yet, but there is. So you have one for, you have an inventory where you can keep track of the stuff you own, and which can be handy. There's a tab for bills where you specify all the regular bills. And then there's a tab for invoices where you can specify money people owe you. But I haven't played with that yet.
Okay, so you need to start billing people, Bart. You got to start working on that part.
I do, actually, yeah.
You're going to pay other people.
Some. Yeah, I told Allison I forgot to bill a few people recently, mainly because I wasn't doing my accounts, to be honest.
Right, right.
Because I hadn't picked new software in 6 months.
Now, you can't completely, like, it, you've got to have something to complain about, right?
Absolutely, this is me. So the first obvious shortcoming I came across was a lack of tags. And to me, tags and keywords are ubiquitous these days, and I depend on them everywhere.
Hmm.
So something I do, because I have business me and I have personal me, and personal me has a credit card, but business me doesn't have a credit card. So when business me has to buy something online, personal me buys it, and then business me pays personal me back.
Oh, interesting.
Because it all has to be tallied up like that, because under Irish tax law, there's a separate bank account for business me, and everything to do with business me must come out of that bank account, and nothing not to do with business me should ever come out of that bank account.
So you have to have records of those transactions.
Exactly. So when I buy something on the credit card and I'm looking at the statement, I used to put a tag on it that said to repay. And then I'd let a couple of them collect up and then write transfer money from my personal account from a business account to my personal account to repay those purchases, mm-hmm. so that the business account would tally. And so I just put a little tag on them to repay, and then I had a smart account which would just list everything to repay. And then as money came into the business account, and I say, ah, okay, I can afford to pay myself back for that router now. Ba-dunk. Okay. And I'll pay it back and take off the tag. But there is no tag support in money. So I've ended up having to set up the smart account, because it does do smart accounts. I've had to set that up to do the smart account based off of some random keywords, for want of a better term, in the description. So I just write in all caps, to repay, and then search for that. But that's prone to typos, doesn't autocomplete. It's a bit of a hack. It does work, but it's not as good as
a nice enhancement request to them then.
Yeah, which I will make, actually, now you mention it. So that's one thing. And then the other one is just the only other thing I've found to make me grumble, and it was a minor thing and my muscle memory has now adapted. But when you create a new transaction, it does one of those sort of Mac type page spits out and slides over kind of things. And you start going through all the forms in order, and they autocomplete in really nice and sensible ways. I'm really quite happy with it. But at one point you come to a sort of a half text field, half drop-down menu for the category. And so I usually begin to type the first one or two letters so that the autocomplete is in the right area, and then hit the down arrow, and then it becomes a drop-down menu, and your cursor is at the right point alphabetically in that drop-down menu. So it's category and subcategory, so it's category colon subcategory. So one category could be, say, business expenses colon hosting, business expenses colon domain registration, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I type BU and then hit the down arrow, and you know, the first one selected would be business expenses, and then hit the down arrow once or twice to get to whether it's hosting or domain registration. And then my instinct is to hit enter to select it, which I don't think is unreasonable, is it?
No, that's exactly what I would expect.
When you hit enter, it commits the transaction.
Oh.
Which is not good, because the three fields underneath that drop-down menu are the amount, who you paid it to, and a comment. So at that point, you've just committed a zero transaction.
Oh, okay.
Which is not fun. Now, you can go in and edit it again, but the amount of times I've done that and had to go and edit transactions just made me cranky. So the correct thing to do is hit tab, which didn't come naturally to me, but I've now learned, after all those hundreds of transactions,
right?
I've now learned, yeah, to hit tab, and that works fine. So really, to be honest, that's it. That's all I have to complain about.
Wow. You know,
which is a lot for me.
Right. While we've been talking, I've been poking around the Jumpsoft site, and I don't understand how we never found these people. They have tons of fantastic applications. They've got Money3. They've got a customer relationship management software, some project management tools, instruments for fun business. I'm not sure what that one is.
Fun
processing.
I claim that doesn't exist, but carry on.
They've got a Sublime outlining application. And the thing I've got to say is every icon, every single thing on this page is absolutely gorgeous. And they've even got a whole section they call goodies. And the goodies are all free stuff. And it's just, to eye candy, I just can't stop looking at these pages. But they've got keynote photos and stills. They've got something for Sandvox. I'm not sure what Sandvox is. They've got numbers, templates, keynotes, themes, mail stationery, keynote objects. All of this stuff is free and just beautiful.
I must check out those themes. They're always good to have.
Oh, yeah. I looked at the company, and they've got, there's about, 10 people or so, and several of them are graphic designers. So you can see
that shows.
Right. But a lot of them are actually doing the real work, too. So this isn't a small fly-by-night company of one poor guy trying to do everything. And explains why it's so beautiful. I'm just going to download a bunch of stuff here.
It's beautiful graphically. It's also beautifully thought out interactive-wise. They're well-polished apps that have smooth workflows, and they feel nice to use. And they're very, very Mac-like.
Yeah. Oh, man, I just want to sit here and look at the pictures. I don't even care if it works. So everybody should go check out jumpsoft.com, JUMSOFT.com. And, even if you just sit and look at it. But I'm going to start checking some of these things out. This looks like they've got add-ons for keynotes and pages. They do have a lot of stuff you can buy, more stuff you can buy, too. Keynote themes, pages clip art, pages templates, pages templates pro, pages templates expert, if you're really crazy about this stuff. Aperture themes, iWeb themes, mail stationery.
Cool.
It's just gorgeous. Well, this is cool, Bart. I'm glad you are finally done with your quest, and now you can make your fame and fortune and manage your accounts, right?
Well, now I can get back to sanity. No, basically, I ended up having a week off work because I was injured, and I spent my whole week off entering in accounts.
But at least you didn't hate every minute of it now with Money 3.
That's the thing. To be honest, I'm not going to say that this app makes me jump for joy, and it's so wonderful, but it doesn't make me hate doing my accounts, which is probably high praise.
That's about as best as you could get, I could think. All right, well, we better wind things up here. Bart, I think I'm on schedule for next week just fine, just normal.
As far as I know, well, I don't know about next week because it might be holiday weekend. I haven't even checked my calendar. I don't know, but I will let you know early in the week.
There will still be a next time.
Oh, absolutely. And until then, happy computing.
Well, you know, every week around Thursday or Friday, I think, yikes, I haven't done hardly any work this week on the show. I better get cracking. And every week, the show comes together, and I have tons of content. I even pushed some content off to next week this time. Well, I hope you enjoyed the show this week. I sure had fun, especially with the live audience. If you'd like to see the show created live on the internet, head on over to podfeet.com/live at 5 p.m. Pacific time. I'm back to my regular time. You'll get to see my shining face, watch GarageBand and Feeder with images from the show notes, and most importantly, talk and chat to all of the Nocilla castaways, like Chief Nocilla Castaway Rose, Mara and Kevin, who are in charge of telling me to save, and Connor P., who's giving Quality Control Director Steve a run for his money and his attention to detail, except he hasn't come to the show much lately. We had a lot of fun in there. But I promise you, it's a very, very welcoming crowd. They haven't thrown out anyone yet. If you'd like to keep track of when the live show is, I've put a link in NoCillaCast Live webpage at podfeet.com/live. Now, what you have to do is copy that link. It's a very, very long Google link, but you have to copy it. Don't click the link. If you click it, it's not going to work. Copy it, and then open your calendar application, choose subscribe, and paste in that URL. You'll get up-to-date information all the time on all of the events, especially the tweet-ups coming in Ireland, England, and Belgium. Don't forget that we're going to be there around the end of August, early September, so you want to keep track of that while you're listening. So anyway, during the week, you can also keep up with my nonsense by following me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Until then, thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.